The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Robert J. Stegman presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. This case this afternoon is 424-1389. I should mention before we start that we're starting a little late, but that's because we had a oral argument we just finished. So I apologize to counsel for our late start, but that's how things sometimes work. In this case, as I mentioned, it's people of the state of Illinois versus Gary A. Irby III, 424-1389. I'll ask counsel for the appellant. Please state your name, sir.
James Waller with the State Appellate Defender's Office.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellee, please state your name, sir.
Matthew Goldman for the people of Illinois.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Waller, on behalf of the defendant, you proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Waller. It's my pleasure to represent Gary Irby before you here today. We raised four issues on appeal, but today I only intend to devote my time to issues one and two because they both reveal a single repeating flaw in the trial court's approach. At each critical juncture, the court skipped over every less restrictive alternative and went straight to the harshest sanction available. I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions about issue three involving the misleading grand jury presentation or issue four involving Gary's emerging adult proportionate penalties claim. But the heart of this case, and the reason a new trial is required, is the trial court's consistent refusal to consider less restrictive measures before imposing more severe ones. On the first issue, the trial court stripped Gary of counsel without seriously considering any less restrictive alternatives. Illinois law recognizes three paths by which a defendant may lose counsel, right? There's express waiver, which requires full 401A admonitions and a waiver on the record. Everybody agrees that's not what we're dealing with here. There's also waiver by conduct, which requires warnings about the consequences of specific behavior and that continuing in that behavior will cost you your right to counsel. Then when you continue in that, you've deemed to have waived your right to counsel. That's also not what we're dealing with here, because here the court found forfeiture by severe misconduct, which is the rarest category, reserved for extreme, unmanageable threats. That's what the court implemented. And the central constitutional failure here was twofold, really, that the court failed to consider reasonably consider less restrictive alternatives as to the denial of counsel, and that the behavior in question did not rise to the level of severe misconduct such that no warnings were necessary.
Counsel, I have several questions on this point I want to proceed with. First, it appears from the record that the court, on hearing about the alleged threats, spoke to counsel and also spoke to the defendant about it and ultimately concluded that the threats occurred. Would you agree?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And what the court said about this is that Mr. McEldowney sincerely in court indicated that his wariness and fear of attack from the defender is basically too much for him to overcome, and he could not continue as defendant's counsel in a position to overcome, or cannot continue as counsel, and the court concluded it was not in a position to overcome that judgment by counsel. Should it have not accepted those representations?
Well, counsel's subjective concern, which may absolutely be valid, I don't claim that he was being dishonest or anything. His subjective concerns are not the controlling test for constitutional deprivation. The court should have either first of all, the court is required to maybe test those restricted alternatives, shackling him, removing him, moving him away. Now, counsel said that he didn't think he'd be able to hide his distrust of his client, even if the client were in a holding cell, communicating only through bailiffs and physically situated from. Counsel said he couldn't hide his distrust. Okay, then we need to appoint new counsel, unfortunately. Your Honor, Justice Stegman, you even mentioned in Ames, in People v. Ames, that sometimes we just need to appoint a new attorney and charge the defendant $5,000 for it. You know,
we'll talk about Ames in a moment, but
sure.
I have some other questions. Trial court in its findings said a forfeiture of a defendant's right to counsel results from a defendant's severe misconduct and requires no prior warnings or admonition. Is that correct?
Is it correct that the court said that? Yes, I believe so. Yeah, that sounds right.
Is that a correct statement of the law?
That that extreme misconduct requires no prior warnings. That's correct. That's my understanding.
Okay. The court also said forfeiture of counsel is reserved for the most severe cases, causes in cases of misconduct and should result only when less restrictive measures are inappropriate. You've indicated disagreement with that. So I guess some other questions at this point, but first, what less restrictive measures on this record could the trial court have imposed?
A booze hearing. We shackle the
A what
defendant.
hearing?
Same thing we'd have in a booze hearing, Your Honor. We shackle the defendant. We sit. The court actually gave, I don't want to say lip service. The court mentioned several alternatives that it could investigate: separating them, shackling the defendant, having him even appear remote or through a holding cell door.
So
Those are all
when you mean by
alternatives.
separating him, you mean defense counsel would not have been at the same table?
Yes, those are some of the alternatives that the
Is
court
there any
acknowledged.
precedent for that? Are you aware of any case in which that has ever occurred?
Well, certainly there are numerous cases where the defendant has been shackled. As far as can I name any case where somebody's been seated separately?
Yeah, you
I'm
suppose there's
certainly.
a problem with seating defense counsel separate from his client in a courtroom at trial?
It's certainly less restrictive than taking away counsel altogether. And I've certainly seen, to answer your question, Your Honor, absolutely have I seen cases where we've sat the defendant back in a holding cell and he has to communicate loudly through written notes to the bailiff. I've absolutely seen that with my own two eyes, Your Honor. Yes.
But how about in the courtroom itself?
I'm that's what I'm as far as well, I'm
I'm
saying
seeing
we
where a defendant is at one table in a courtroom and the defense attorney is at another.
No, but that seems less restrictive than putting him in a holding cell and having him communicate through writing, which we've seen. So,
Okay. Also, your position seems to be that there has to be a warning before the court can find forfeiture by severe misconduct. Is that correct?
nope, that's not my position. There needs to be a warning if it's by less severe. If it's waiver by conduct, there has to be a warning. If it is extreme misconduct, there does not need to be a warning, but the court still needs to investigate less restrictive measures before denying the right to counsel. That's what a constitutional right really is. It's the last resort before we violate something like that. So there does not need to be a warning. Now, the court tried to say that there had been warnings, but then said that it found that does doesn't even apply because it was finding extreme misconduct. My position is the court did not investigate less restrictive measures, and also that this really doesn't quite rise to the level of extreme misconduct. You asked a moment ago, Your Honor, if that's a correct statement of the law, that extreme misconduct doesn't require warnings. It is, to the extent that there's really any developed law in Illinois on this point. I really think Ames, your Honor's own opinion, kind of laid this out. I won't say quite as a case of first impression, but because there has not been a case in Illinois or anywhere in the Seventh Circuit where anybody has ever found forfeiture by severe misconduct. And I've personally seen conduct much more severe than this, but nobody's ever found a forfeiture by severe misconduct in Illinois or the Midwest, maybe. This
Well, I
court
have
looks
Ames in
to.
front of me. I want to run a few quotes by you and get your thoughts on it.
Okay.
Another method of relinquishing the right to counsel is forfeiture, which occurs only after severe misconduct. An example of such misconduct occurred in the United States versus McLeod, 11th Circuit case.
Right.
In McLeod, the trial court conducted a hearing on the defense attorney's motion to withdraw, at which the attorney testified that the defendant was verbally abusive, threatened to harm him, repeatedly threatened to sue him, and so forth. The court concluded the defendant, by virtue of his pervasive misconduct, had forfeited his right to counsel. And
Yes.
Ames also cited a Pennsylvania Superior Court case where the court concluded the defendant forfeited his right to counsel through his pattern of serious misconduct, abuse, and threats. So why isn't that a recognition of threats? And one other thing, by the way, a quote from Ames. One of the differences between waiver of counsel and conduct, waiver of counsel by conduct and forfeiture of conduct, is the latter may occur because of the defendant's severe misconduct without the defendant's first having been warned of the consequences of his engaging in that severe misconduct. This is still quoting from Ames. Trial court has the discretion to determine whether the defendant's misconduct was so severe, such as physically attacking defense counsel, that no warning was necessary. So, are you arguing that because this court in Ames used as an example of a defendant's severe misconduct is physically attacking his counsel, that we are holding that a credible threat by defendant to physically harm his counsel would not constitute severe misconduct?
Your Honor, I think the key to the answer is that what the language you actually quoted there from Ames, which was pervasive. It was because of pervasive misconduct, repeated threats to counsel, repeated threats to sue him, repeated coercion to get him to behave unethically and to file unethical things.
Well, with
The
me, I
the
want to
words,
leave that all aside for the moment. I'm
well,
not
they were key. They're
interested
key to
in.
your answer, Your Honor. They
Well,
are key to
no,
your
I'm
answer.
talking about threats of physical harm. That's where I want to focus. That's where I want you to focus your attention. Threats of physical harm. You're maintaining that somehow Ames didn't include threats of physical harm as being pervasive misconduct?
Ames does not stand for the idea that a single threat of physical harm rises to the level of severe misconduct. We could make that finding, but this would be the first case to do so.
Why shouldn't
Because, well, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the Sixth Amendment's important, right? It should removing counsel should be the last straw when there are more when there are plenty, there are a plethora of other solutions that the court can implement before violating a fundamental constitutional right. We can shackle them. We can separate them. We can appoint him a new attorney.
Well,
There are.
how would appointing a new attorney make any difference?
Well, if well, the court relied on several reasons here to find extreme misconduct, right? The court found the threat. The court found that that because the defendant had made pro se filings and made a number of requested continuances, all of this fell under extreme
So
misconduct,
I
and
want
because
to
there were
focus on
disagreements.
threats. He threatened, the defendant threatened physically two different attorneys.
I'm okay.
Why isn't
My
that
point, Your
enough?
Honor, is in Ames, you cited other cases that relied on more than just a physical threat. And for the things that aren't a physical threat, we can give them a new attorney, right? On the things that were a
What's the
physical
new
threat.
attorney supposed to do? He's supposed to wait until he gets threatened again?
So if we're talking about just a physical threat, then replacing the attorney may not be the best solution, but we have the others. I've been in court when attorneys are physically attacked by their client. It's unfortunate, and we don't like that. We have measures to prevent that from happening. We shackle them. We separate them. You communicate only through written notes. You communicate through the bailiff. Those are things we can do that are and if the problem is the problem here was that counsel said he couldn't hide his fear and distrust. If that's the problem, then we get him a new attorney, and maybe we make him pay for it. But we don't strip the constitutional right to attorney based on one threat that is unchoate at that point, and
One
frankly,
threat that is what?
that has been inchoate at this point. And
Why
frankly,
shouldn't we adopt? Why shouldn't we adopt the language of the main Supreme Court cited by Mr. Goldman in Nesbitt? Here's the quote: "No attorney, particularly including appointed counsel, whose willingness to accept appointments in criminal cases is critical to the vitality of the right to counsel and whose work contains a strong element of public service. No attorney should be expected to tolerate threatening conduct from a client." And in Nesbitt, Supreme Court of Maine said this is forfeiture by severe misconduct and took away the right. Why shouldn't that be the rule in the state? And to the extent that what I wrote in Ames wasn't clear enough, how about let's making it more clear now?
Your Honor, frankly, I believe the Sixth Amendment is made of sterner stuff. And you're right as a defense attorney. Should we want them to put up with the occasional threats? No. But frankly, it's almost commonplace. If this court was aware, like it happens so often that we're going to end up with a whole slew of pro se defendants because these types of threats are made. They just are. It's sub
Yeah,
rosa,
but
and it
counsel,
happens.
if it happens that often, and we accept what you're really advocating is sort of a one bite rule that until there's actually an attack, there's no remedy. You're worried about the future. I'm worried about having enough defendants represented by counsel in any case, because who wants to do this work? If
Well, I do.
when somebody threatens to physically harm you or your children,
Sure.
that we won't protect them by saying you don't have to do this. And just putting somebody else in the same position seems like a really poor answer.
I think, Your Honor, here's a direct answer for you, if I haven't been direct enough. If this court says that a single verbal threat of harm to the attorney, to the attorney's children,
Attorney's
anything like
children.
that, if that is sufficient to restrict the right to counsel without warning, this will be the first state to do so. And it will be such a low bar, I think it will have catastrophic effects on
Can I
representation
ask you
downstream.
about the, you keep saying that there was never a warning.
And on page 1745 of the record, it says, as he's appointing the attorney in question, he says, in the event this doesn't go well, in other words, the defendant doesn't like what's happening or gets dissatisfied and wants to take another route, he'll be expected to proceed pro se. Now, I would
That's
say,
not the Constitution, Your Honor.
I would say it's a warning.
But it's
and
not
I
the Constitution. He can say whatever he wants, but that doesn't make it the law.
Well, no,
I'm
no,
sorry.
No, 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 no.
Sure.
You have said the judge falsely said he warned him previously. And I'm just pointing out that you're wrong about that. He did warn him that if this doesn't go, if you become dissatisfied. Now, he way overshot dissatisfaction when he threatened physically his lawyer. But the point is, when you say there was not a warning,
I see.
You better watch yourself with this lawyer, or else you may have to go pro se. You're wrong about that. The record contradicts you.
Your Honor, let me make a clarification on my position then, because that's a great point. There was no warning tied to the specific behavior that led to the removal of counsel. But the behavior that I believe at that time, I don't remember which judge was sitting at that time, but the behavior he was complaining of at that time had nothing to do with what later ended up costing counsel. And he was
don't,
begging.
Don't you this think was, that if you can't do that, that it's pretty clear you shouldn't physically threaten your lawyer? Don't you think that that's that manifestation of dissatisfaction, a threat to somebody's safety, is clearly well above that level of conduct?
Your Honor, that warning is the same as saying, if you speak loudly in court, I'm going to take away your attorney. Like, it's not a constitutionally valid warning, because not getting along with your attorney doesn't mean you don't get an attorney. It just doesn't under the Sixth Amendment, under any case
law. You
keep
equating that, counsel, not getting along or being disruptive with making physical threats to
I'm
harm
not,
counsel.
Your Honor. I'm answering Justice Doherty's question
well,
about the warning.
In
I'm saying
it,
he was not warned.
And how about if we firmly and unequivocally reject that equivalence to say,
well,
no, physically harming doesn't work ever?
You can reject it, Your Honor, because I'm not making that equivalence.
Yeah, but
I'm happy to move on, because that's
hasn't
not what I'm
every
saying.
Parent heard this kind of argument, right? Well, you told me I had to get along with my brother. All I did was threaten to kill him. I
right,
mean,
but warning
that
him
seems to be within the scope of the warning.
Possibly, and in which case, I'm happy to say I misspoke by saying there had never been any warning. There was no constitutionally valid warning, because that threat is not constitutionally valid. You can't threaten to take away somebody's lawyer because they're not getting along with their lawyer, or because they request a continuance.
If I may, other than
please.
An act of physical violence, what conduct would be severe enough, in your opinion, to justify a finding of severe, that the defendant forfeited their right by severe misconduct, then,
sure.
Other than
well, and
an act of physical violence?
And I think that goes right to it, Your Honor. What we shouldn't have is a bright line rule. In the prior cases, in the other extrajudicial cases that have found this, it has been a repeated pattern of pervasive conduct. That I don't believe has happened here.
Well, I guess
so
my question is, if we put it together that the first attorney, he threatened that attorney, threatened the attorney's children, he then continued to threaten the attorney after that attorney was no longer his lawyer, when he saw him in parts of the courthouse, and it appears to me the judge found this to be credible, if you will. He then got a new, went pro se, then got a new attorney, and then proceeded to threaten him and report him to ARDC. How is that not a pervasive course of conduct?
Well, first of all, your point about the threats to the multiple attorneys, the first attorney didn't find the threat to be such that it required being reported to the court, or even that he sought to withdraw as counsel based on it. So I don't.
But if the court at this hearing,
sure.
If the court at this hearing took the objective approach and heard all that evidence, mm-hmm. and made that determination and said, I find this a severe misconduct. Now, second tier, I'm going to ask, as alternatives, and if there are ways of salvaging this, then he makes the inquiry to the court, to the attorney, to say, is there anything we can do? Because he's already found the conduct was severe enough to warrant forfeiting his right to counsel.
Sure.
I guess, so I don't find fault with the court asking
and
counsel if there's any way to salvage that. So I guess I appreciate that the first attorney did not withdraw, but that's his subjective belief, perhaps, that was not warranted, or perhaps he felt so concerned he couldn't, but I'll leave that for another day. But this information now becomes before the court in one hearing. It was very clear this was going to be addressed. And I think the court when it started to make inquiry of counsel at that time as to whether there was anything that could salvage this relationship, the trial judge had already determined that severe misconduct had occurred. And so that was the objective approach before we ever get into the subjective feelings of counsel. If in this case counsel had said, yes, I think I could do this for whatever reason with whatever accommodation, then I think the question is, well, is that still a
In which
reasonable
case,
threat?
of course, Your Honor, and which, again, I think reasonable people can disagree as to where that line is, and I think that we should not have a bright line rule. But the more important problem with this case is that the court did not implement a less restrictive measure than a constitutional denial of the right to counsel, and that's where the court made the mistake. The court made the same mistake with not granting the continuance and therefore denying outright the alibi defense. It did not take the less restrictive approach. I'll ask to speak to this a bit on rebuttal. I do want to give counsel an opportunity to respond to what I would have to say about the second issue briefly, though, which is again that the court had an opportunity to take less restrictive approaches there by granting the state's request for a continuance after the possibly late disclosed alibi defense.
But your client objected to a continuance, correct?
The court, he did object to the continuance, but he did so before knowing that that was tied to his request for the alibi. He says, "Well, I don't want a continuance," and then the court says, "Well, then you can't have the alibi defense." This was a direct result of him not having his attorney. If he had had an attorney, the court would have said, "Counsel, you can't turn over a late alibi defense and then object to the continuance. I'm going to grant the continuance." That's what the court should have did. It can't be treated as a waiver or forfeiture because, again, he didn't know what the, if you read the record, that objection, that knee-jerk objection is given before he understands that decision is tied to whether or not he can pursue his alibi defense. He should have been given the opportunity to either withdraw his objection or the court should have just overridden it and granted the continuance. But it's not an informed waiver because he doesn't understand the consequences of objecting to the continuance. Because the court
Counsel,
tied to him. Sorry.
I've asked you a lot of questions and my colleagues have as well. Your time is up, but I want to give you some additional time because this is an important subject and I want to make sure we all have an opportunity to ask you questions and they may have some as well, but I have an additional question I want to ask you about all this. Assuming a trial court conducts a hearing of whatever sort and determines after talking to a defendant and his lawyer, that a credible threat to inflict physical harm was made upon the lawyer. Why shouldn't it be the rule that that's enough in and of itself to find forfeiture by wrongdoing of the right to counsel and strip the defendant of his right to counsel at that point, right then?
It shouldn't be, Your Honor, because it weakens the Sixth Amendment too much.
Well, that's my
It's
second question, by the way. What in the Sixth Amendment would prohibit such a rule from existing?
Well, the fact, first of all, the fact that there are less restrictive measures, the whole point of a constitutional right is that you take it away as a last measure. The existence of less extreme responses to that, where we can provide for the defense counsel's safety. And frankly, defense counsel being unwilling to represent somebody after a threat is such an outlier that we could take some steps to take care of that. If we can take the steps to
Well,
take
by the
care of
way,
that
you
before.
mentioned it a couple of times. You mentioned shackling, but I've never seen a situation, maybe there are some, where a shackled defendant had his hands shackled in front of the jury.
I've
His
seen
feet
situations
shackled.
where he's duct taped in front of the jury. And I've absolutely
What
seen
about his
situations
hands
where
being shackled in front of the jury? Has
I
that
couldn't tell you
occurred?
firsthand if I've seen that. I've certainly seen situations where he has to communicate remotely, or through a cell
Because
door.
if a defendant is sitting next to a lawyer, and he wants to take notes, or his lawyer is taking notes. They can grab a pen or pencil. The defendant could, if he were intent on inflicting harm. And by the way, of course, talking about a guy who's charged with cold-blooded first-degree murder, his attorney might be a little concerned. This isn't a DUI case about grabbing a pen or pencil and trying to stab his lawyer sitting next to him before court security people could intervene. Why wouldn't that be a legitimate concern?
It should be a legitimate concern, but then we see them separately. There are less restrictive options. There are things we
Other
do,
than
especially I'm talking to you on Zoom, Your Honor. We could have remote court. My client, I'm not in threat from my client in any shape or form right now. So
can
there
I
are.
ask you some additional questions? I want to give my colleagues a chance as well to ask, or if you wanted to finish up the point you wanted to make otherwise.
Thank you. Yes, I'll just jump right back in case there's unless there's any other questions. I just want to point out that on the second issue, under Rule 415G, a continuance is the first least restrictive remedy. The court did not, the court has reversed when the same thing has happened in Hauser. This court reversed in Hauser. This court reversed in Foster. And other courts ruled similarly in Gracie, Brooks, and Levin. If you deny somebody their entire defense, it's tantamount to not even really having a trial. And if there are less restrictive measures, the court needs to have taken them. If all you have is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And it seems as though this court took the hammer and nail approach to every problem that was presented by implementing the most severe consequence to everything that happened before it. So it's impo I think this was a murder prosecution, Your Honor, of against somebody who was 21 years old, educated in juvenile prison. And in a case like that, taking away counsel should be the last thing we do. We should exhaust every other possible resource before taking away such a fundamental right and before taking away their defense, which is basically just as damaging as taking away their counsel, especially when that defense was dictated by the counsel that you took away from them. Not you, obviously, when the court took away from them. So, anyway, I don't want to continue to beat that horse, but
Counsel,
I
if I may,
appreciate your
just
time.
following
Please.
up on that, just for one moment. The defendant, there was a time period after he had counsel where he was pro se as well, much earlier on in the proceeding. So
Right.
he could have raised the alibi defense at that time, couldn't he?
Well, Your Honor, we know that he didn't get all of his discovery until like a week after he lost his second attorney.
But it's
So
his
yes,
own alibi,
right,
and he's pro
absolutely.
se.
He
So
absolutely.
wouldn't he have known? Wouldn't that be within his inherent control of knowledge?
It was sure, and what we have is evidence on the record that that was his intent. And when he brought it, his counsel on, counsel says he disclosed an alibi defense to me. I chose not to pursue it. I can, and the court held him to that. So it's clearly it was his intent to, and he brought it on his attorney before his alibi obligation to turn over was complete because the state still hadn't even given him all of their discovery. So he could have turned it over. He was not required to yet. When he brought counsel on, he tried to get counsel to turn over an alibi defense. Counsel said he wasn't going to, and then the court took away counsel. So the court denied him the expertise on how to defend the case without an alibi defense and then didn't let him present the alibi defense. So that's a massive
Allow the
problem under
witnesses
Feretta.
to testify, though, correct? He just didn't allow them to establish the alibi.
Right. He denied the defense. That's right. Which again, in a case like this, where we're talking about the GPS, we're talking about the location, which is the whole defense. That's the entire trial. So, you can't do both. You can't take away his counsel and hold him to counsel's without impugning the problems under Feretta, where he gets to control his own defense. If the problem is waiver or invited error, the problem is that the issues were never tied together. He was never explained that the objection would cost him his alibi defense. So there was no informed consent. There was no waiver by counsel or anybody else. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you for the extra time. We asked for a new trial based on those two issues. I'm also happy to talk about issues three or four if you want, and I'll see you again in rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Goldman, on behalf of the state, you may make your argument at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So turning
Sure.
first to counsel's first argument regarding the discharge of counsel, I think Your Honor's hit the nail on the head that this was a situation with pervasive misconduct. This was not a one-time instance with a single attorney. If a threat perhaps occurred to just one attorney, maybe that attorney could fairly think, maybe this is a personal issue. Somebody else might be able to get along better with this defendant and simply move on. It appears that's what happened with Hugh Toner, except it then happened again as soon as the defendant got his new attorney. So this isn't something that was specific to one attorney and some kind of breakdown in communication. This is something that this defendant was doing over and over and over again. I think particularly chilling is when you look at the record and the defense attorney is recounting what happened during his interactions with the defendant. He explains that after the defendant made his threat, the attorney inquired, is this just you being a little upset or having hard feelings? And the defendant apparently calmly explained over the course of approximately 10 minutes how serious he was about this threat. When he showed up in court, he claimed that he never made this kind of threat. But then they found a recorded phone call in which the defendant explicitly states that he threatened his attorney just moments before the phone call. And so this is a situation in which this defendant was not only making these threats, but being very essentially lying about having made those threats because he knew how serious the situation was. He knew that these threats were unacceptable. Because of that recording, we know that counsel's concerns were not merely subjective. He described the threats that he made to the defendant using multiple ex excuse me, to defense counsel, using expletives, talking about how he said that he was going to essentially beat up his attorney, and his attorney said that he would have to withdraw on that phone call. And that corroborates the defense attorney's description of what happened during that threat. The fact that this happened to two attorneys shows that's pervasive, but also the fact that the defendant threatened the children of the first attorney shows that this is not a threat that was limited to a personal attack. The defendant was in jail. Ostensibly, the only way that the children would be at risk is if somebody else were to go after the children. So the fact that he's implicating other people who are outside of the court system shows that this was a particularly dangerous kind of threat. When the court, excuse me, one of the solutions that defense counsel on appeal is suggesting that they could be separated, is something that perhaps could be done in the court's discretion. But I would argue that if they were separated, we would be up here on appeal talking about how the fact they were separated indicated that this defendant was so dangerous that he had to be treated like Hannibal Lecter and separated from everybody else. And that would also implicate other rights of the defendant. And so there's not a perfect solution here. I think that this court was correct in Ames when it said that this is a matter that is left up to the trial court's discretion. The court identified several factors in that decision and in later decisions that the court can consider when determining whether or not severe misconduct occurred. The court described verbal abuse, threats of harm, threats to sue, attempts to get the attorney to do something unethical, and yelling combined with refusal to cooperate. Verbal abuse certainly took place in this case. Threats of harm certainly took place in this case. Although a threat to sue specifically did not occur, the court seemed to take the ARDC complaints as something of a similar nature. Obviously, it's a different kind of a threat, but taking away somebody's law license or threatening to do so seems to be of at least a similar nature as threatening to sue them for money. The attempts to get the attorney to do something unethical, the trial court referred to the pro se filings, to the attempts to get the attorney to file what the court considered to be frivolous claims. Additionally, although it's unclear whether or not there was any yelling, there certainly was a refusal to cooperate. With all of these factors that this court has identified previously, applying some of them perfectly, some of them somewhat imperfectly, this court should conclude that the court was well within its discretion to determine that this was severe misconduct, it was pervasive misconduct, and for that reason, the trial court was within its discretion to discharge counsel and find that the defendant had waived his right to counsel under these circumstances. Now, I share defense counsel's concerns about the Sixth Amendment here. And I can't remember which justice said this, but I think the other thing to balance against that is the concern that there may not be enough defense attorneys willing to represent clients if those defense attorneys are constantly being threatened. And I understand Mr. Waller's comments about how this is something that defense attorneys have to deal with from time to time. In a prior life, I was a defense attorney as well. This is not something that's completely foreign to me. But it isn't something that should be tolerated in circumstances in which the defense attorney does think that the threats are serious and real. Defense attorneys do have to make decisions. about whether or not to report these things, whether or not the threats are serious, whether or not the defendant is so dangerous that they should be taken seriously. Apparently, in this case, Hugh Toner was threatened, his children were threatened, and maybe he is simply made of steel and decided that this is not something worth reporting, this is not something that I'm overly concerned about, and brushed it off. He used his discretion as a professional to decide that this wasn't the time to do so. When the next attorney came along and got threatened in a different way, that attorney used his own discretion to determine that the threats were real, that these were significant, that he could not represent this defendant any longer. These are all situations in which different defense attorneys are going to have different opinions. But the fact remains that when it is brought to the court's attention and is addressed, and it's proven that this is something that is serious, pervasive, and credible, the trial court should be allowed to use its discretion. The trial court should be empowered to use its discretion to act in the way that the court did in this case. Your
Which
Honors,
suggests to us and to trial judges on dealing with these kinds of circumstances.
I'm sorry.
What bright line rule or court of binding precedent trial courts will be looking? We have lots of cases dealing with consumptive dependence of one kind or another. So, what's the rule that you would suggest we provide for trial courts and counsel here?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that this is a situation in which a bright line rule makes a whole lot of sense because each of these circumstances is going to depend upon a wide variety of factors. Whether there's verbal abuse, whether there's threats of harm, whether this has happened on one occasion or multiple occasions, whether this has happened to one attorney or multiple attorneys, these are all things that the trial court should consider in utilizing its discretion. Now, whether or not a single threat would justify it, I think that that's something that, depending upon the circumstances evaluated by the trial court, it could justify it or it could not. The trial court could, after evaluating all of the information before it, determine that that threat was made in the heat of the moment, or perhaps as a joke, or it was made fleetingly, or it was made to one particular defense attorney. And the court has reason to believe it wouldn't be made to another. And so creating a bright line rule in which you say one threat automatically means that the Sixth Amendment can be taken away, right to counsel can be taken away, I don't think is necessary. However, I would say that this court should reiterate the factors that it's reiterated in Ames and elsewhere, and say that the court should be allowed to consider these factors in order to, in its discretion, determine that stripping the right to counsel is the appropriate outcome. I would argue that this court does not need to go so far as saying that one particular thing is, means that the right must automatically be stripped, or it means that it's automatically justified, just because of the complex nature of these situations.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I would just again emphasize that public defenders have to tolerate a lot in their jobs. I know Your Honor Judge Steigman has stated in the in prior decisions about how they have to deal with difficult cases, difficult clients, oftentimes brutal workloads. But they should not have to endure the circumstances found in this case. This case. Whatever bright line rule your honors might have in mind, this case surely goes beyond it. This was a situation with pervasive, serious threats by a defendant who was accused and later convicted of first degree cold-blooded murder. Under these circumstances, this court should conclude that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. And because no clear or obvious error occurred in this case, no plain error could have occurred. Unless there are any further questions on that first point, I'll turn to the second point raised by counsel. The argument that barring the alibi defense was an error. Again, no clear obvious error occurred regarding this issue. This was an alibi defense that was disclosed the day of trial. And I believe it was Justice Leonard who pointed out that this was not the first time that this defendant had been pro se. This defendant had been pro se for months in 2023, and during that time could have disclosed at any time this defense that he wanted to raise. He did not do so. Now, defense counsels brought up the fact that all of the discovery had not yet been produced. That is true. However, this is an alibi defense. This is a situation in which it should not depend upon other things that could come out in discovery, where the defendant was on that night. He knew where he was. It depended upon what other evidence showed whether or not he was going to say he was in this location or another location, that certainly does not speak well to the validity of this alibi defense. This defendant knew where he was on the night in question. If he thought that he was at his home during the time that the murder took place, he would have known that from day one, and he would have been able to disclose that during the initial pro se period. Additionally,
Counsel,
when oh, excuse me.
if you will address also appellate counsel's reference with regards to the continuance, if you will, where the defendant indicated that he wanted to proceed with trial, but that the assertion that at that point it had not yet been explained to him that he, by doing so, he would be foregoing any opportunity to present that alibi defense, and so that was premature, if you will, at the point that he indicated he wanted to proceed with the trial, and that the court should have made further inquiry after, if you will, providing him that warning. How do you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. So, under those circumstances, the defendant, as you noted, explicitly rejected a continuance. Everybody in the courtroom was asking for a continuance, essentially, except for him. Although he might not have known everything that could have resulted from his choice to deny that continuance, under these circumstances, this is one of the difficulties of going pro se. I certainly understand defense counsel's concern that this is a situation in which he had that right stripped from him due to severe misconduct rather than choosing to go pro se. But the fact that he was pro se, I think when we look at this through the lens of other circumstances in which people are pro se, they're generally held to a similar standard. They're not given a whole lot of extra leeway due to the fact that they are pro se. Obviously, this is one of the dangers of being pro se. This is one of the reasons why perhaps he should not have threatened to physically harm his attorneys and have his attorneys then be discharged. I certainly agree with counsel that things might have gone differently had he had an attorney. Now, that attorney probably would have said, due to the fact that the GPS data puts you at the scene of the crime, we're not going to do an alibi defense because that flies in the face of all of the evidence that we have. But the method in which they proceeded with this this continuance might have gone differently if he had the advice of counsel. It's a tough situation to be pro se. But when a person is pro se, they have to unfortunately live with their decisions. And by rejecting a continuance, without, having looked at all the case law, having looked at how courts tend to handle these things, without having looked into the Supreme Court rules as to what are the proper remedies for a late disclosure of a defense such as this one, and knowing how courts may treat this, that's something that unfortunately the defendant has to live with as a pro se litigant. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Your Honors, I would argue that due to the fact that he did reject the continuance, he was offered the kind of relief that he now essentially seeks on appeal, and he rejected it. This court should conclude that the defendant invited the error that he is now complaining of. And because it was an invited error, this court should conclude that he cannot seek relief under the plain error doctrine, and that therefore this claim should be rejected. Unless there are any further questions, for the rest, I'd simply stand on the strength of my brief as written. And thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Mr. Waller, you may make a rebuttal argument this time, but coming as no surprise to you, I'm sure I have two questions I want to ask you first. And if necessary, I'll give you additional time because this is a point where an argument I want to make sure everyone's had a chance to speak. First question I want to ask you is actually two parts. You mentioned you do not seem to be arguing that serious misconduct occurred in this case, but your primary argument seems to me to be that the remedy used by the court was excessive, namely to deprive the defendant of his counsel. Is that correct?
I mean, that's certainly my fallback position, Your Honor. I will
Okay,
say my
well.
and just to be just a real quick clarification there is there has been, as you know, no firm case law in Illinois on what makes severe misconduct. So in the absence of that, I say this doesn't reach it. If this court finds that it does, then absolutely it should have exhausted less restrictive measures.
Okay. You mentioned one of the remedies, I think a few times, would be to have the defendant at a different table in the courtroom, or to have the defendant maybe in some separate room while the defense attorney was in the courtroom. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that both of those circumstances, Mr. Goldman argued, would be severe impediments to Sixth Amendment right to counsel, as we understand it. And not only would that be a problem, but how would Judge Waller explain to the jury in your courtroom why that is now occurring? What explanation would you give?
Well, Your Honor, would it be an impediment to the Sixth Amendment? Yes. Would it be as strong an impediment as taking away your right to attorney completely? No. And that's what we're saying. We need to have the least, it's not just lesser, the least restrictive measures is what we need to investigate here.
And
And
what's your
they weren't
instruction to
reasonably
the
considered.
jury?
Well, I would try, if I could find a way, first of all, I would just try shackling him. And if I had to, if I could avoid bringing it up, I would. If circum if after I exercise my discretion said he has to be separated, I would frankly not I would not draw attention to it. I would ask both counsels. I would explain this is being done in order to protect his right to counsel. I'll ask counsel's suggestions for how we want to address it with the jury, if at all. And I would take that into consideration. My first instinct would be not to draw anybody's attention to it, to treat this as standard operating procedure. And but I would see how the counsels in that particular situation, based on the circumstances of that case, how they would suggest that we should move forward. Because
Second
it should be
question
fact
is,
sensitive. Sorry.
let's assume that no threats had been made in this case, but he had been an unhappy defendant, as many are, and he's sitting at counsel table, and while sitting there, he leans back and smashes one of his attorneys, his then current defense attorney, in the face and knocks him down and causes an injury.
Which I've seen.
Okay, would that be a basis to find that he is now forfeited by misconduct his right to counsel?
I would try to do everything I could to avoid making that finding because I think that the right to counsel is sacrosanct. But that I think should be the my position. That should be that's a situation where a reasonable person could find the line. Absolutely.
Okay. And
But
there's no warning. He
what
hasn't been warned. Don't hit your counsel in the face and knock him out.
I think that a warning should be appropriate,
You mean
if possible. But
routinely to
again,
defendants, or at what point do you make this warning?
well, I'm saying, ideally, I mean, I would t talk to counsel too. Again, everything should be fact specific. In that case, I think it would be not necessarily unreasonable to find that severe misconduct had occurred if an actual demonstrable attack had occurred at open court. I'm not arguing that point with you. I think
Okay.
reasonable people could find that. Again, this would be the first case to do so, and if that's the way it
Even
is, that's
though
the way it
no
is.
warning had occurred. Is that correct?
If we had to, again, I would prefer a system in which you I would to take Justice Doherty's, I don't know that a one bite rule should be absolutely off the table, but fine. I'm not going to be unreasonable and say no way everybody should get to do whatever they want. I understand.
Okay, counsel, I asked you some questions. I want to give an opportunity for your rebuttal argument and also for my colleagues as well.
I
Go ahead.
appreciate it. Counsel talked about, and Your Honor asked about it a little bit too, about how maybe other rights of the defendant are implicated by these less restrictive measures. But we have booze hearings. We have circumstances where we've had to duct tape defendants. We always treat the denial of counsel like all of these things do impact the rights, but the right to counsel is one of the most, it's an enumerated right. It's foundational. It's backed up by a lot of case law, and we impair that right when we have to, but in Illinois we just almost never take it away, and I think that should continue to be our practice. So yes, you lose some things when you get duct taped, when you have a booze hearing and you're shackled. Sometimes courts even have to make a finding that he has to be shackled here, and I'm going to have to explain it to the jury. That's still better than denying you the right to counsel, than just completely taking away your right, a constitutional right like that. Again, I think that ARDC complaints for defense attorneys are, I don't want to say commonplace, but they're certainly not a rarity. You get a letter to the ARDC, you write back what happened, that's the end of it. It happens maybe annually for a lot of volume practitioners. That's not the same as numerous lawsuits to the attorney, and so it's not quite the same as equating it to the misbehavior we saw in McLeod. But with all that in mind, the fact that we have the risk of being attacked, the fact that we know we're going to face ARDC complaints, I don't think that that has impaired the availability of defense attorneys in the state. I think that salary might, but I don't think that those have caused a paucity or a dearth of defense attorneys. We know those going in. We do it anyway because it's a calling. So I don't think that the law staying as it is right now would cause there to be any future lack of defense counsel. Counsel also.
Counsel, don't you agree, though, that it's different to say we do this knowing there's a risk versus saying the judge will make you stay on the job after there's been multiple threats?
Sure,
Those really
sure.
aren't equivalent.
They're not equivalent, but I don't believe that we're going to lose all of our defense attorneys just because that happens. Same way we didn't lose all cops when we came up with the exclusionary rule or 1983 litigation. It's a give and take, but it is different. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. Absolutely. Counsel kept talking about how the court exercised its discretion. I want to make sure we're clear. This is a de novo review. The whether or not counsel was improperly denied under the Sixth Amendment is a de novo review. We certainly want to defer to their factual
Wait a minute.
findings.
Who says that? What, on what basis is this de novo? Why isn't this a matter of the trial court's discretion based upon the circumstances with which the court has confronted the misconduct of the defendant to decide whether or not this requires the forfeiture by wrongdoing?
Sure. I mean, I've got the standard of review in my brief, but whether or not the count defendant was deprived of the right to counsel is reviewed de novo. That's People v. Leslie, 2018 Illinois Supreme Court case. Standard of review of adequacy of counsel is also reviewed de novo. That's People v. Leeper. And again, Your Honor said in Ames, if a court of review determines that the trial court improperly forced a defendant to represent himself at trial, there's no such thing as harmless error. So again, the courts of review on de novo review make that determination. Now, the courts
Should this be
determine.
the review? Why isn't this a matter addressed to the trial court's sound discretion based upon the circumstances, the attitudes, the behaviors, the fact finding the trial court is making in the courtroom?
Because that's frankly Illinois law. The determination of whether he was denied his right to counsel improperly is de novo
Well,
review, and we'll have to take that up with the Illinois
that
Supreme Court, Your Honor. I
these
mean, that's
cases are all
black and white
seems
law.
fact intensive, counsel. I'm not sure that
Sure.
there's a
And for credibility determinations, we should absolutely defer to the trial court. But whether or not he was improperly denied his right to counsel is de novo review, and that's black letter law in several cases. And again, it was also recognized implicitly in Ames. So we should defer to their factual findings, but everything else is on the record. And I think this court has no problem making that determination de novo as to whether or not he was properly denied counsel, not only as to whether or not there was extreme misconduct such that no warnings were required, but also whether or not they properly investigated the least restrictive measures, that can absolutely be determined on de novo review. And again, we're bound by that anyway. Again, I don't want to abuse your tolerance on my time here, so I'll move on to the second issue. Again, there was more discussion about how while he was pro se, Gary didn't disclose his alibi defense. I would again argue that he was not required to at that point. When by the point counsel was reappointed, he still had time to disclose his alibi defense. It was counsel's decision not to disclose it, and the court kind of makes a mess of it. And I've got the language here. The court tells Gary, this is R2045, that it was his counsel's decision not to tender an alibi defense and that his record is protected. And he can argue that counsel made the incorrect decision, but also that would not apply because he lost the right to counsel, but then it still reassured him that his record is protected. Well, that right there shows the problem with conflating counsel's control over his case with any possible waiver or anything else, or his own tendering of an alibi defense. He can't claim IAC because you took away his attorney. And so you can't bind him to the count. You can't say it was counsel's decision not to tender an alibi defense. He still had the opportunity to tender an alibi defense. In fact, and when we talk about his objection to the continuance, he's getting discovery days before he goes on trial for first degree murder, still getting discovery.
What
He
does the
asks for
discovery
continuance then
have
and it's denied.
to do with the alibi defense?
Well, it goes because at that point he asks for continuance himself based on this is because the disclosure of an alibi defense is a discovery violation. That's all it is. You have to it's rule you have to disclose it in discovery. So a late disclosure of an alibi defense is a discovery violation, just like turning somebody over their discovery a week before trial and then denying them a continuance when they ask for the continuance. So that's why they're tied together. He asked for continuance. The court says no. He says, I got an alibi defense. The state says we want to defend a continuance. And he says no. His thought at that point is almost certainly, you're not going to give me a continuance when you're dropping 350 gig or 35 gigabytes of video data on me a week before trial. You're not going to give me a continuance. I'm going to object to any continuance you ask for them. Again, it wasn't an informed waiver
Well,
because he didn't
counsel,
know the
but it
consequences.
seems clear from the transcript that the court was weighing two things. The court was weighing the defendant's request regarding the alibi defense, and then it was weighing the state's request for a continuance because of that. And it took those under advisement. It seems as though they were pretty well married and should have been understood by the defendant as being flip sides of a coin, that we
Your
didn't
Honor,
want to go one way or the other.
I think a closer read of the record shows that this court was going to do everything it could to not grant a continuance. It says that all the way, it drips through every word of the denial of his right to counsel. The court wants to keep this thing. This thing's going to trial May 22nd, and it makes counsel keep coming back to make sure he gets
Right. But
discovery.
the point is, defendant knew these were linked issues.
I don't believe that that's on the record, Your Honor. If you read it. In sequence, they don't tie the issue together. The court never turns to him and says these are the same thing. They want a continuance. They don't even get into whether or not the continuance is based on the alibi defense until after he objects to the continuance. So I don't think you can't say that it was a waiver. And without waiver, this is a clear and obvious error, and it deserves a new trial. You can't take away his attorney and then bind him to the decisions of that attorney and remove his only ability to make any kind of defense. And we shouldn't really treat the GPS as be all end all. There was something weird about the GPS reports. If he had been able to put in three witnesses that said, this is where I was, and if I wasn't there, why didn't it show up on my probation violation report? You might have reasonable doubt. This might be a triable issue. But they took that away from him. They denied him the defense, therefore they denied him the trial, and they denied him the counsel at that lack of trial. So with those in
So
mind, a new trial is necessary.
one last overarching question, if I may,
Please.
quickly. Do you concede that the defendant did not properly preserve any of the issues that you're raising before this court, and you're looking for an exception to that, such as through the plain error doctrine?
I would have to double check each one. I believe that I did raise plain error on almost every issue in the reply brief. It certainly I do have reply. I do have my reply brief has plain error on everyone. I do think that the grand jury. I think there's a good argument that the grand jury issue was preserved. He raises it maybe not as clearly and explicitly as we want to, but he files a motion to dismiss the indictment for prosecutorial misconduct pre-trial. He's not very verbose about why, but in the hearing for that, he explains the situation that she never said street name Gary Irby. She says Guwop. The police officer supplies that information to the grand jury and maybe not intentionally, but makes it sound like she said his street name is Gary Irby.
Okay.
So
Thank you, counsel.
I do believe that one's preserved.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you all.
Before concluding, I want to mention that this is a interesting, difficult case. The courts asked you a lot of questions, primarily I did, and I appreciate Mr. Waller, your response to all of them, and Mr. Goldman, that you were responsive as well. It's always a service to the court when both counsel are able to respond appropriately and answer the court's questions. So I want to thank you both for doing that. And with that explanation, then we will take this matter under advisement, stand in recess, issue an opinion in due course.